Hi, I'm Deb.
This is Frankie V.
I'm Grant.
Hi, this is Phil.
I'm Aaron.
I'm Steven.
Hi, I'm Jim.
Hi, I'm Matt.
We're Tim and Terry.
I'm Susan.
Hi, this is Phil.
Seminary Dropout is supported by listeners like you and me.
Seminary Dropout is supported by listeners like you and me.
You should support the show like I did.
It's easy.
It's easy.
Just visit supportseminarydropout.com.
Just go to supportseminarydropout.com.
And I'm your host, Shane Blackshear. Interviews with leading Christian authors, leaders, and thinkers. Let's go. My guest, John Dixon, is an author, speaker, historian, and media presenter. John is the author of more than 20 books. He teaches a course on the historical Jesus at the University of Sydney, Australia, and researches the origins of Christianity in the Roman Empire. He's an honorary research associate at the University of Sydney, a visiting academic in the Faculty of Classics at Oxford University from 2016 to 2021, and Distinguished Fellow of Public Christianity at Ridley College, Melbourne. John presents Australia's number one religious podcast, Undeceptions, exploring aspects of life, faith, history, culture, or ethics that are either much misunderstood or mostly forgotten. His new book is Bullies and Saints, an honest look at the good and evil of Christian history. John, welcome to Seminary Dropout.
Thank you, Shane. I love the title.
Well, thanks.
I would have dropped out if I could.
It's better for us that you didn't know that was an option. You know, I was thinking about it, John. All of a sudden, in the last 2 years, the world has produced a ton of amateur epidemiologists. I don't know if you knew this or not. And the only problem with that is that a lot of them are wrong in what they think about epidemiology and how that works. It turns out that going to school for 10 years to study medicine and disease and viruses matters, apparently. And I feel like Christian history is much the same way, that there are a lot of armchair Christian historians. And I just wonder why you think there's so much disinformation around Christian history.
Because it's part of the wider trend of disinformation around history per se as part of the culture wars. And so, you know, there was a time when history was regarded as a science. It really was called a science. And that's because it deals with hard data. And then, like any science, you have to interpret the hard data. The hard data is the archaeology, the inscriptions, even the literary remains from the ancient world or whatever. And then these are interpreted. So it is a hard, it's got an element of a hard science. And over the last, I mean, I'm not really a historian of the modern world, but I would say over the last, let's just say during the 20th century, there was a tendency to just use snippets of history, of narratives, to bolster my contemporary political narrative. And we saw that being used, I mean, the most extreme example is the Nazi Party's use of, you know, the history of the Aryan race and so on, all of which was nuts, but it was just used to bolster a political ideology. But we do it all the time, and it's infected Christian history. So that you do get Christians who will know a tiny little bit about the Crusades and then use the Crusades as part of a crusading mentality today, or as speaking to our Middle Eastern politics situation today. It's the mere use of history rather than actual history that is our problem. And so, yeah, your observation is right. You do have to go to school for about 10 years before you open your big mouth on this sort of topic.
Well, I think that was one of the beautiful things about the book, was it was you very expertly exposed kind of the subtleties and the contours of Christian history, and that it's, you know, as you said, the tagline is honest, look at the good and the evil, and it's much worse and better than most people think and suspect. I feel like, you know, there are two kind of ditches that people fall into, and maybe if you grew up in a Christian home, well, the Christian history that you learned was, you know, some of the beautiful things about the early church, about taking care of the poor and the marginalized while being persecuted. And, you know, you learn about martyrs, and then maybe you learn about Martin Luther, who, you know, spoke against indulgences.
Hang on, you jumped a few days there.
On purpose, because that's it. That's the Christian history we get if we grew up in the Christian church. It's about it, right? But on the other side is, you know, people who are antagonistic to the faith, you know, it's all about the Crusades and the Inquisitions, and even, you know, being in America, it's been about imperialism, and even, even though our wars in the Middle East have not been quote-unquote Christian wars, they have been supported by Christians who have this kind of crusading mindset. You know, we're going to bring democracy, which is just as good as Christianity, to these countries, right? I think that one of the beautiful things about the book is you're so good at not letting anybody get away with either of those things.
Yeah, well, in some ways that was the goal. I mean, I wrote the book, to be honest, partly out of therapy for myself. I think anyone who's been reading history and Christian history a long time needs therapy to try and puzzle through how the people of the cross could end up, you know, slaughtering in the name of Jesus and thinking it was a holy thing. And partly because I wanted to correct the record on both sides of the ledger. So I like the way you've put it, because on one side of the ledger, there are Christians who think that Christianity is basically a story of, you know, grace and persecution and love and hospitals. Apart from that wobbly bit in the Dark Ages, but we don't count them because that's the Catholics. We didn't pop up until the 16th century.
Convenient.
And then on the other side, you're right. You've got the new atheists who really think it was all about the Inquisitions and Crusades. But the reality is it's mixed, and it's mixed in every century. And sometimes it's mixed in the one character. And so a classic example is Constantine. You take Constantine in the 4th century, the first Christian emperor. I think Americans say Constantine. But anyway, I come from the Anglo-British Australian tradition. But Constantine is often used by, let's just say evangelicals, conservative evangelicals, as a kind of, that's when the church went bad because, you know, Constantine was just a phony Christian and he started to corrupt things. He made the Catholic Church in his own image, and we can dismiss it. The reality is, if you read the sources of Constantine, he was a brutal emperor, but he was also a humanitarian legislator, gave everyone a weekend off. He softened punishments that he thought were inappropriate for human beings made in the image of God. He also allowed all the religions. He didn't impose the Catholic Church on the population. He allowed pagan religions to survive, even though he was clear he didn't believe them anymore. He allowed them to survive and thrive. He just gave Christianity the same rights that the pagan religions and the Jewish synagogues and the philosophical schools had. Now, that's the fact, okay? And we can interpret that in different ways, I suppose. I mean, you could, if you squint hard enough, you can see it as the beginning of the end for the church, right? Becoming too formalized and Roman. On the other hand, you could say it was the turning point that allowed the church to do great good, because indeed he did allow the church to do great good. Once they were legal, they were able to start their hospitals and poverty programs. They could own property finally. And what they did is they purchased vast tracts of land and produced food for the poor on those lands. So you could take it either way. The thing is, history has to be honest about both. And I don't leave my Constantine chapters saying, and there you have it, Constantine is, you know, the good guy or the bad guy. He's like a lot of Christian history. He is a mix, a bumbling Roman emperor who was brutal, but also a great humanitarian who tried his best to allow the church to flourish. That's just one example from the beginning of the 4th century, but, you know, I find this throughout history. It's mixed, and unless you're willing to accept the mix, you probably can't do history.
Well, you answered about like five of my questions in that monologue there.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No. About Constantine. So let's put a pin in that. I want to go back or forward, however you look at it. You begin the book with diving into the Crusades, and then after you cover that, then you go back to earlier Christian history. And so I wonder why you thought it was important to kind of frame the book in that way, with starting with the Crusades.
Yeah, it is odd at one level, but there was method to my madness, and the method was, it's the ultimate cliche that the critic will throw at the church. The Crusades, you know. I've had people say to me, Christianity started all the wars of history. And I say, which ones? And they go, the Crusades. Right. So it's good to start the book there at the cliche, the thing that people recognize, and try and give an honest account of that. But it's also the halfway mark. The Crusades start exactly halfway between Jesus and Shane. And so it's a good point to sort of go, this is where they ended up 1,000 years after Jesus. How on earth did they get there? Good question. Let's wind back, right? And so I wind back then and work out how Christians who started out, you know, weak and shamed and persecuted, how could they one day end up thinking that to stab a Muslim brought forgiveness of sins? And there's a story to tell there, and it didn't happen overnight. A lot of things transpired. But I think once you understand how it happened, you don't forgive it. And this is not a book of historical relativism. What you do is you understand it, and then you think, oh my goodness, I wonder what my blind spots are, what my acquiescing to culture is right now.
Right, right. Because I feel like you really get to see that in this book. Again, in the subtleties and the contours of history, you can see that these people, some of the same people, did some really good things and then just could not see other things that are very, very obvious today because they were people of their time.
Yeah, that's right. And yet when you read the sources, you can't go for the easy dismissal. Oh, they weren't real Christians. They didn't really believe. Or people say, oh, no, the Crusades were all about politics, or they were all about land grabs. None of those explanations holds. It's not even true to say they were entirely defensive wars against Muslims. There is a truth to that, and which I acknowledge in the book. There is a truth, and many Crusaders thought that they were defending Christendom from the violent aggression of Muslims over the previous 200 years. But there was also, there was politics. Pope Urban II didn't have a secure position. And it's pretty clear that this was a way of securing his position as Lord of Christendom. You just have to be willing to find that some of your heroes were at times scoundrels, or at least that some of the heroic times were also filled with scoundrels. I'm not saying every Christian leader throughout history was a mix of bully and saint. But there are examples of that. But there are also examples where there are more bullies than there are saints, and other times when there are more saints than bullies. But it's mixed either way.
Well, let's dive into the Crusades a little bit, because I learned so much. I have to admit, I knew almost next to nothing about the Crusades. And I was definitely one who would say they were political land grabs. I just thought, because it's so unlikely to say people who were following Jesus of Nazareth used that motivation to go and slaughter a bunch of people, or, you know, however you want to describe it. So, okay, let's get to the nuts and bolts of the Crusade. There are really like five different Crusades, correct?
That's
broadly
correct,
speaking.
Yes. I mean, in the East, there were other Crusades that were not to the Holy Land. And there were Crusades down into Spain. There were Crusades in the south of France even. But, you know, I leave those aside because the famous Crusades are the five in the East. And they were mostly failures. That's the other thing that's not well known. The first Crusade worked, but that was it. And once the Muslims retook Jerusalem, the Crusaders never got Jerusalem back.
Yeah, and it seems like the first one is really the only one that kind of fits the stereotype of Christians really. I'm not justifying the other Crusades, but the Christians really kind of bullying up and slaughtering their enemies and it being a decisive military victory in that regard. Like, the first one seems like the only one.
Yes, the First Crusade was the successful one. On July 15, 1099, they breached the walls of Jerusalem and slaughtered men, women, and children. And that, you know, changed Jerusalem for a little while, not long. But the thing is, the First Crusade, you could argue that the First Crusade was also the only crusade that was really a response to Muslim aggression, because the First Crusade started when Alexius, the emperor of the Byzantine Empire, the remaining Christian empire in the East, was threatened by Muslim armies at his door. And he wrote to Western Europe, to Pope Urban II, and pleaded him to come and protect this last remnant of old Eastern Christianity. And that's when they responded with their armies. So, you know, in a weird way, Shane, I totally agree with you, but the First Crusade really does look like, at least in theory, a just war. If there is such a thing as a just war, a response to aggression to protect the innocent and so on, the First Crusade was, in theory, a just war. However, what they did in the conduct of that war makes it an unjust war. They slaughtered Jewish communities along the Rhine as they made their way to the Holy Land as kind of practice and payback for what the Jews did to Jesus, ostensibly. When they arrived, they did slaughter men, women, and children in taking Jerusalem. Now, that broke every rule of just war. And then they held a church service the day after, on July 16, to praise Jesus for his victory over the evil Muslims. So, again, it's the dilemma of church history at the very point where you might think, if I squint hard enough, this looks like a just war. When you open your eyes, you see that they conducted themselves in a despicable way, and in a way that was remembered by Muslims as a great evil and shame against them. However, in the Second Crusade, the Third, Fourth, and the Fifth were all failures. They never were able to take Jerusalem again, and the Muslims remember the Crusades as that great failure of Christendom. Until very recently, in the early 20th century, Muslims started to talk about the ancient Crusades, the medieval Crusades, as what Europe is always trying to do to Muslim lands, always trying to push us around. And it's the modern idea of crusading that has been imposed on the medieval Crusades as the great bully church, you know, pushing around the poor Muslims. Well, that, I mean, apart from July 1099, That didn't happen. The Muslims well and truly beat the Christians.
Yeah, okay. So the idea of the Crusades being this moral failure because they were kind of slaughtering defenseless people that we see, like that is although they're isolated incidents of that, that is more ahistoric and more of a recent invention.
Yeah, well, there are enough stories of Christians behaving badly for you to pluck them out and say that's what the Crusades were. But actually, there were more Muslim victories than there were Christian victories, is all I'm saying.
Yeah.
They were failed campaigns, and they ended with a whimper.
For them to be a bully, they would have had to at least win the battle, right? So, and they didn't even do that. So there's a lot of failures and stalemates and that sort of thing. You said something earlier that I'm not going to get over. You said that most evangelicals will say that when Constantine came to power, that was when the church was corrupted. And things went badly. I think, and maybe this is the difference between American evangelicals and Australian ones, but I think that most Americans would American evangelicals point to Constantine as something wonderful that happened because Christians came to power. That's beautiful. It's funny. It's really funny you said that because I'm kind of a more of an Anabaptist leaning person. And so I kind of look at Constantine in that time with suspicion that this was the time when church got power. But I feel like I'm in the minority of American Christians in feeling that way.
Yes. I mean, it's an interesting thing because evangelicalism has traditionally, even the sort of conservative mainstream evangelicalism, traditionally been anti-Constantine because he supposedly founded the Catholic Church and made the Catholic Church all Roman. And so it's that good old-fashioned evangelical hatred of things Catholic that has created this suspicion about Constantine. However, there's a more political evangelicalism that is, how shall I put this, less angry at the Catholics and more happy about the integration of church and state, that now can look at Constantine and see benefits. And of course, the Anabaptist tradition has always, lamented what happened when Constantine converted and was suspicious about it and thought it wasn't a real conversion, it was all political, etc. And both are caricatures. Constantine really believed. He really tried his best to honour Christ as he understood it within the confines of being a 4th century Roman emperor raised in a warrior culture. And he did wonderful things for the church. And among, he did some things that the Anabaptists would love. For instance, he forbade wealthy elites going into the church because the church should not be made up of elites. It should be run by the poor, even the bishops. It wasn't until the end of the 4th century, long after Constantine, do you get your first bishops who were from the senatorial class. And that's the real change, 50, 60 years after Constantine. But in Constantine's period, no, he insisted only the poor can run the church. And the church was very happy with that because that's how they'd run the show for quite a while. He created all sorts of humanitarian laws. He insisted that Christians continue to pick up the newborns that were discarded by Roman families as a way of birth control, really, just getting rid of babies. Christians scooped them up and Constantine enacted laws that made it easier for Christians to do that. They got support, financial support from the government so that they could run their programs. So there are all sorts of things that are, I think, the Anabaptist tradition would love. And yet, there's the other side as well.
So one of the specific things he did that allowed them to be more, what we would call charitable or philanthropic was he didn't tax the churches. And you said something in one of those chapters that, the Jewish synagogues that weren't taxed at the time? Like there was other entities that weren't taxed at the time.
Yes, he didn't privilege the church. He just gave the church the same tax concessions that were already available to philosophical schools, to all of the pagan temples, and to the Jewish synagogues even. And that was a huge change. So the thought that we won't tax the churches because they're doing so much good in society, that's a radical change. And is still on the books to this day. I mean, churches in most parts of the world are not taxed for this very reason. But it goes back to a law that Constantine passed. He also allowed people from the middle class in the church not to have to, if you were, say, a middle class priest, because you could be middle class and priest, you just couldn't be elite and a priest, they didn't have to do their voluntary service, which was a form of taxation in the ancient world. Because if you were middle class, if you were from a certain segment of Roman society, you could be called upon to sit on the city council and you had to do it. You could be called upon to host soldiers on your property. And this was just regarded as the thing you have to do. Now, he exempted all clergy from that because he said, no, what they're doing is way more important. And what it did, oh, and the other thing he did, he allowed people to bequeath their wealth to the church. That was a significant rule. That hadn't been lawful until that point. So people who were faithful Christians who died could leave their whole property to the church. And that enabled the church at the early 4th century to do extraordinary things. They were soon building massive hospitals that were free of charge for everyone. They, as I mentioned earlier, were starting farms. These farms were for the poor because, you know, they got to the point where it wasn't just about giving the poor, you know, a denarius or something. They just knew that you had to have a whole system of raising, you know, tons of grain to help the poor. There were so many poor people. And this wasn't happening in Roman society. The Roman government did not care for the underclasses. And it wasn't till much later that governments thought that they should do that. And as a result of 1,000 or more years of Christianity caring for the poor, the government took that care up into its own legislation. But in this early period, the Romans didn't think that there was any obligation to care for the poorest of the poor. And as a result, the church became beloved, especially amongst the poor. And even the middle class and wealthy were drawn to the church. They weren't allowed power in the church in the 4th century, but they were really drawn. So in the middle of the 4th century, just after Constantine dies, we think we've got pretty good evidence there were quite a few senatorial-level people attending church, amazed at the kind of new humanity the church was inventing before their very eyes. And so that by the end of the 4th century, those elites who were sitting in the wings of the church, attending, believing, they ended up becoming the powerful in the church. So there was a shift in about 390 where it became the norm for elite Romans to also become church leaders.
Well, I think one of the shocking things to me was that during this time, as you alluded to, the church used this privilege, and I don't mean newfound privilege, and I don't mean a privilege over and against everyone else, but these new benefits, and seemed to be really good stewards of those benefits. Not for their own benefit, but to you know, feed the poor and you know, the widows and the orphans and so on and so forth.
Well, they read the gospel, didn't they?
what a concept.
And they knew, I mean, this is why churches were happy to exclude the elites from church leadership for this very reason, because they knew that would co-opt them into a kind of materialistic and power culture. So yeah, the church continued to do this. And the interesting thing is, even when the elites entered the church at the end of the 4th century, they knew that their obligation was to the poor first of all. So I have a long chapter about Ambrose of Milan at the end of the 4th century. So there's a generation after Constantine. And he is the first senator level, and he was a Roman senator, full-on Roman senator, and a governor, a Roman governor, who becomes a bishop. And he's just parachuted in by popular demand, I'll say. The people of Milan wanted him as their bishop. Now, he is the elite of the elite. Finally, you have this turning point where in one of the most important cities in the empire, Milan, you have one of the most elite intellects, rich people, powerful bullies, now a bishop. But even still, he was the champion of the poor. So, you know, for me, he embodies the ambiguity of church history. Because at one level, I could have written a chapter that just wrote Ambrose off as simply the bully. And he approved of the burning of synagogues and things like that. So there was some very dodgy things about him. But if you'd asked a poor family in Milan in, say, 390, what do you think of Ambrose? They would have said, he is our champion. He is the reason that we have food in our belly, we have a roof over our head because he puts us first. And it's true, he did. He gave his own personal wealth to the poor, and he made sure all ministers that were under his control were the poor first, the poor first. So, you know, even when the elites are running the show, if they're reading the gospel, they still know they have to use their power for good.
Yeah, I mean, that chapter, to me, it just showed me how, again, if we're looking at it through the lens of, you know, how do we get from Jesus to the Crusades, Ambrose of Milan was just, it was just a click in the wrong direction, you know? He was very, very morally ambiguous when we look at his life. And I would say, especially, look, in America, when we look at our leaders who claim to be Christians, our secular leaders who claim to be Christians, very few of them care much about the poor at all, and certainly don't put personal wealth at risk to help the poor.
Yeah. This is why it's such an interesting story. Ambrose really did. As I say, he was the champion of the poor. And he set a new model. You're right to say it's a click. And really the fundamental thing that he did, I think, is established a new way of being a bishop. Up to that point, bishops thought that they were primarily teachers, carers of their flock. They were heresy warriors, yes, but they also, you know, they were the shepherds. Whereas Ambrose had this vision of the public Christian as the mayor, the bishop as the mayor. That's really the model, okay? And he had the power of a mayor. He actually told the emperor what to do on more than one occasion, and the emperor did it. He gave other bishops the confidence to act like mayors of their diocese, of their towns. And you do begin to get, after Ambrose, you do begin to get this more muscular Christianity that's willing to use its public credibility to get their own way. And that often is terrible because they accrue great wealth to themselves and so on. But other times it's a great thing. I mean, you only have to go across to Cappadocia, to the Cappadocian fathers, who are mostly known for their work on the Trinity. They're sort of theological nerds, Basil of Caesarea, Gregory of Nyssa. But actually they were, they would be dismissed as social justice warriors. I know that's a boo word I just used there, but they were absolutely committed to establishing hospitals. We think that Basil of Caesarea was the person to establish the first public hospital in world history. And it had six different departments: a department for lepers, a department for the elderly, a department for the simply sick, a department for the discarded babies, and so on. These are people using their power and their elite status for good. And almost entirely good. You don't hear anything from these guys about pushing the emperors around. You don't hear anything from these guys about wars. In fact, Gregory of Nyssa preached the first abolition message that we also know of in all of history, preaching against slavery at the fundamental level, not just at the practical level. Oh, we should be kinder to slaves because God loves them. He said it is absolutely abominable to think you can own a human being made in the image of God. All I'm saying is this is exactly the same time as Ambrose. Right? So it's a very different character.
So one of the things that I'm seeing, and if anybody's a real reader and has come across Tom Holland's Dominion, who I know he gave a blurb for your book, kind of his thesis is that, like, Jesus really changed things. And Tom Holland's a secular historian, and basically saying, like, these things that you call Western values, that slavery is wrong, that we should care for the weak and the marginalized, one, they weren't natural, quote-unquote natural, for you to think. They weren't inevitable. We weren't inevitably going to start thinking that that something happened with the Jesus and his teachings and his followers and Judaism as well really changed the way we thought of things. And these things we call human rights now that seem obvious weren't for a very long time in different cultures. And so I guess what I'm getting at is that you really put flesh on that as we see Gregory of Nyssa and those around him starting hospitals for the first time, starting and the churches that are, you know, growing crops to feed the poor for the first time. This is a really new thing in the world. Like it seems like to us, we could just get caught up and say like, well, yeah, that's what churches should do, you know, but that was a really weird kind of thing to do at the time.
Yes, I think Tom Holland's thesis is undeniably true. He is a little more complimentary of Christianity than I am. But nonetheless, I think that thread I would share. Because if you were in ancient Greece or Rome, there was no welfare system. And people often confuse this with the emperors sometimes putting on gladiatorial games for the population or opening the storehouses during periods of famine. But this was only ever for citizens. This was never for the great majority of poor people who weren't citizens and were not able to even get their portion of grain. So this notion of you care for the most vulnerable in society came entirely from, first, the Jewish view of reality. But the thing about Christianity is that it universalized Jewish ethics. So I think it is valid to talk about the Judeo-Christian worldview. I mean, that spooks some people nowadays because they think it's code for, you know, white Western European power. But, you know, it, just as we talk about Greco-Roman as the combination of Greek culture taken over by Roman culture, it is right to talk about Judeo-Christian culture as the Jewish ethic that was then universalized because of Jesus and the apostles. And it treated human beings as infinitely and equally valuable, regardless of capacities. And people now assume this is the case. You know, you speak to your average secularist mate in Austin, Texas, of which I know there are many, you know, secular, humanitarian-minded people, yeah? They will assume everyone's equal, everyone's, you know, infinitely valuable, etc. But I've often had this thought experiment, and I've had the conversations with such people. I said, if you went back into the first century and you met a thoughtful first century Roman and you tried to say every human being is infinitely equal, you know, valuable and equal, they would say, you are out of your mind. And I bet you'd lose the argument. And so I will often sometimes pretend to be a thoughtful first century Roman and say, okay, try and convince me that everyone is infinitely valuable and equal. All right, go. There's almost nothing they can say, but we're all human, they might say. But that's like saying all metal is the same value. We know that's not the case. Some humans are stronger, better looking, richer, more educated, more intelligent. How can they not be more valuable? And we could to and fro on this. The logic of the Greek and Roman mindset that humans are stratified, that humans are not equal, it could not possibly be the case that they're equal, is very logical. It is profoundly rational. But unless there is a God in the universe who created all people and loves all people equally, right? That's what changed everything. And it our secular humanitarian friend in Austin no longer believes that, sure, but they believe the relic of it, the ethical implication of it, without ever pondering why it is true. We know empirically, historically, that only became a truism because of the influence of Judeo-Christian thinking. And philosophically, it is extremely difficult to argue for the inestimable equality of human beings. And, you know, the American founding fathers were a secular way of putting it, but, you know, it's still theological in the way it's framed, right? That the Creator has endowed everyone with, can't remember the Declaration of Independence, inalienable rights, right?
You're right. We're talking about, what we're talking about without talking about it is the Imago Dei in each of us. We're talking about loving our neighbor as ourself without saying it. We've just come up with secular ways of saying that.
Yeah. And it's a real question. Can we continue for much longer with the ethic when we don't have the theoretical framework for it? I mean, this is a question I put to Tom. I interviewed him for my podcast recently. And I said, so, you know, obviously the world has gotten rid of this idea of the Imago Dei and God's love for everyone. Do you think we can last long? And he said, it's too early to tell. Yeah, that's probably right.
Well, how do he, like I said, he's not a believer. He's extremely sympathetic to Christianity. How does he hold it together?
Yes, well, I mean, one of the other questions I put to him was, does it, I mean, if Christianity isn't true, then these things that you say you love, you know, equality, don't exist on your own thesis. So, you know, why do you hold that they're not true and yet you hold, you know, why do you hold that the theology is not true, but the ethic remains true and attractive and so on? And he basically said he's still on his journey. So I think I'll give him that. I'll let him live in that ambiguity, where he knows that the equal dignity of every human being, regardless of capacity or utility, can only be grounded in a Judeo-Christian vision of humanity. And, you know, maybe we'll be hearing in the coming years that the great Tom Holland has come to actually believe those things. I mean, he said to me in the interview, some days I do believe it, and then other days I don't. So, work in progress.
He did a short series with N.T. Wright on the Ask N.T. Wright Anything podcast. And he had some very similar moments like that, very vulnerable. And you just feel like, oh, you're close, man. Like, you keep going that direction. It's going to be very difficult to not go all the way. But it's really fascinating. Fascinating book and fascinating person, too. So, John, just being such a good student of Christian history, to you, who are your heroes of Christian history? Like, who do you think, yeah, I want to be like that guy, or girl or woman, who stands out in your mind?
Wow. From which century?
Yeah. Right. I know that's,
do I have to choose?
Small little question there, right? Should we divide it up?
Well, I love, the Cappadocian fathers, and we've mentioned Basil and the two Gregories, because they are both theological nerds and practical carers of the world, establishing hospitals, as I say. So yes, I'll go for Bishop Basil or Bishop Gregory, but in the period slightly after, I could go with Fabiola, the wealthiest woman in Rome. From one of the original founding families of Rome, who becomes a Christian and gives all of her vast wealth away to the poor. And she also starts a hospital. This is 20 years after Basil starts a hospital. And so she would make it. If we were going into the 600s, I'd have to talk about Bishop Eligius, who was the greatest jewelry maker in Europe and got a bit of a conscience about that, and then started using his ability with jewelry to just feed the poor. He would go out dressed in gold and silver, and he'd be giving it left, right, and center to people on his business trips, and come back in shabby clothes. He eventually went into the church as a priest, and then became a bishop, and continued that same mold. And he was a great freer of slaves. He would wander everywhere around Europe. He heard there were slave sales, and he'd go and he'd use all his jewelry to buy them all up and then free them. So I'm going with Eligius, and you're going to allow me one more. We're gonna sneak into the late 700s, and a man called Alcuin of York, a British Yorkshireman, who was the let's just say the most educated man in the world, and Charlemagne, Charles the Great, who was sort of the great Christian warrior and uniter of Europe, employs Alcuin because he saw Alcuin's brilliance to establish schools throughout Europe, and that's what Alcuin does. And these are schools based on the full-on liberal arts. So they had to study grammar and rhetoric and poetry and astronomy. And then only after they've done the liberal arts could they then move to history or theology. And, you know, by the end of his sort of 30 years working in this project, there are thousands of schools for boys and girls, wealthy and poor, throughout Europe. We now take for granted schools. But really, Alcuin is the man who gave them to us. And he did it in the name of Christ. He was absolutely committed to this intellectual principle that everything you know about the world is just more, is knowing more about the wisdom of God. It's a wisdom approach to knowledge. The genius of God is responsible for the world. So whatever you discover about, you know, science or history or grammar or music is just knowing more about the genius of God. And that's why we should study everything, not just the Bible.
No trace of the anti-intellectualism we sometimes see in the church today.
No. He single-handedly created a Renaissance long before the, you know, the Renaissance we think of in the 1300s.
Wow. John, what does this do for you when you look around at the church today? Like the posture that you want to take in the world towards your government and towards your neighbor? How about those two extremes?
Wow. Well, I think Christians are at their best when they are profoundly confident, full of conviction in Christ, but remain cheerful and good losers when things don't go their way. And I see this in the first Christians in wonderful ways. They were such good losers during the periods of persecution, not because they were unconfident, not because they had a slave mentality, but actually because they thought they'd already won. And so Jesus sits at God's right hand, and that's going to be their story too. So all we need to worry about is enduring suffering and turning the other cheek and loving enemies and proclaiming what is true. And so it seems to me what has happened, what so often happens, is the church bifurcates. We get this super confident Christianity that becomes a bully, right? And is not willing to concede anything. When it loses legislative battles, it is outraged. It's a terrible loser, and an even worse winner when it wins and pushes people around, right? That's the sort of convictional Christianity. And then you've got a Christianity that is all sort of love and humility and compassion and no conviction. And it just acquiesces to culture. It compromises the gospel. It won't hold the difficult views that our culture hates. And that's just the mirror image of the bully, in my view. The ancient church and the medieval church at its best, and therefore today the church at its best, is able to be full of conviction, flex that muscle, and flex the muscle of compassion at the same time. We know we've already won. Jesus is Lord. And so we can go into anywhere with the truth. But we do it with compassion and humility. And when we lose, we are cheerful losers because we know we've already won. We can afford to be humble and compassionate. For me, that is the ultimate lesson of church history. And the secondary lesson is not to be self-righteous about my period of church history. Because people 300 years from now may look back on you and me and wonder if we were really Christians because of some blind spot that we can't see. We can only see the blind spots of those before us. We can't see the blind spots of our own time. So a little humility goes a long way.
Well, I think why this book is so important is because it's twofold. Like, one, we can look back and see the really beautiful things, you know, the Gregories of Nyssa and so on and so forth. Those are really faithful, you know? And then the other thing is, instead of kind of like circling the wagons and covering up the bad stuff, we can expose it to the light of day and own it. And then we can deal with it, and then we can learn from it.
Yeah. You know, it was Jesus who said, take the plank or log out of your eye, and then you'll be able to see clearly. And, you know, he said, your neighbor has a speck in their eye. You know, why do you look at the speck in your neighbor's eye and you don't see the log or plank in your own eye? That was said to his disciples, okay? It's not said to the church, to the world. It's said to the church. And so we should be willing to admit we've got a plank in our eye. And you know what? The sins of others should look to us like a speck. The sin of our own soul, the sins of church history should feel like a plank. And that ought to give us a kind of, it ought to kill Christian triumphalism. Christian triumphalism is a sin. If it's the triumphalism that says I must have my own way, the church is squeaky clean, that kind of triumphalism is a sin. The triumphalism that says Christ has already won, and therefore we are destined, no matter how much we suffer, to be vindicated with him, that kind of triumphalism is key, is important. But it's not a political triumphalism. It's not a cultural triumphalism.
Well, John, it was good. Thank you. The book was so fun to read, and I learned so much. And was even, I've got sermons that I'm going to be preaching in my church in the next couple of months, and is thinking like, oh my gosh, this is so applicable to what I, need to say and share. So it was great. John, thanks for being on the show.
Shane, thank you so much. Great conversation. God bless.
Thanks for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Remember, you can find all the show notes for this show and all shows at shaneblackshear.com. Oh, and hey, have you ever thought about starting your very own podcast? I bet you have. And I think you should do it. In fact, I've created a course just for you to teach you everything that I've learned over the last couple of years producing Seminary Dropout. So if you're interested in podcasting and want to learn how, go check out my course. You can go there by typing in podcastingforeveryone.org. And you can get a special discount by typing in the discount code Seminary Dropout, all one word. That'll give you 25% off. So go check it out. If you have any questions, let me know. Okay. Thanks to those that left ratings and reviews on iTunes this week. Remember, that keeps the show front and center. Also, remember, you can find me on Twitter at @beardonabike. That's @beardonabike. Also, I'm on Facebook, facebook.com/ShaneBlackshear123. And remember that Seminary Dropout is listener supported. You can visit supportseminarydropout.com and press Become a Patron. Remember, this music you're listening to right now is by D.L. Rossi. You can find him online on iTunes and at dlrossi.com. All right, thanks again for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Stay tuned for next week's episode. Love you. Take care. Yeah, my best. I always seem to bring